how we are going to run our program. We'll first have a presentation from the Fund for Animals, I4. I'm sure they are ready, willing and able. We will have Professor Van Arden to make a presentation. After his presentation, we will then have a presentation from Trustees of Animal Rights, Rights Africa. It would be Ms. Michelle Tigova and Mr. Steve Smith. After that, after both of those presentations, I think we will then have questions from the members, and after that we will have the department to respond. Professor Van Arde, if someone would be in a position to adjust the light right before the screen here, just to tone them down a little so that the screen can be visible to members. Excuse me a second. It seems as though our recording machines are not on because your mic is not on. I don't seem to see it on. The red light is supposed to reflect on your mic.
Maybe if I could.
Oh,
that's how technology of mine sounds. I do apologize for that. I'm going to go right into to answer for the specific questions that I'm listing here. What are the problems that we are having with that? And I think what I would hope to say to you is that the problems that we are is that the elephants respond well to us farming them, provide them the resources that are usually in short supply, water and food, and that will protect them and stop them from moving, and you will have a problem. For the one primary thing is why we have a problem is that elephants need space, and if we can't provide that space, of course we will have a problem. The other thing that's the problem that we tend to have with elephants is that they do not respond very well to efforts to control their numbers. They don't like to be controlled. They don't like to be told what to do. They do it in a kind of in their own way. They're pretty much like us. And the final problem is that we do not really know how many there are. These find what very many people will claim. And I hope to illustrate to you this in a rather friendly and amicable manner and with some scientific support for that. Let me explain what I mean by them responding well to farming. This is an old map. This map illustrates the distribution of water points in the Kruger National Park between 1980 and 1996, with each of those red dots being our artificial water points. So that about 86% of the total area of the park covered in artificial water. An elephant could hardly go anywhere without being close to a dam or to a borehole. On the right, you see a graph that depicts will show to you how elephants respond to all this water. The more the number of water holes, the smaller the area over which they move. The smaller the area over which they move, the bigger the impact they have in the environment. That's my point of elephants responding well to us farming them. They then do bad things, for they are so intense in the utilization of the land that they are actually having an impact. What I'm providing to you here is one of the mechanisms through which this impact arises. Let me explain it in very simple terms. Under natural conditions, imagine this green being a continuum. You see the red dots there. That's where elephants find themselves in the dry season. They usually concentrate and focus themselves around natural water. And when the rains come, they move into these bigger areas, the green circles, and you see a nice and clear separation and the elephants moving across space. When we fragment the space and we put fences up and we put artificial water, what we do find is that during the dry as well as the wet season, they sit exactly at the same spot. Sitting exactly at the same spot means that the spot never has time during the year to recover. Again, I'm illustrating to you a point about elephants responding to farming. And when you start interpreting the information on this specific graph, I think it becomes extremely exciting to notice that when you look how elephants behave, to the left of the red line, those are elephants. And I in a case, when you look at the scenario to the left of that red line, you're looking at where elephants are finding themselves in the dry and the wet season and how that is separated from the natural conditions. And you will see most of the values are below zero. That means these elephants separate themselves. In one place in the dry season and a completely different place in the wet season. They are hardly in an overlap. However, when you look at the situation on the right, that all present elephants that have been passed, we are seeing that they overlap varies a lot. And the highest line there, the highest histogram point there, the second line on the right, represents the Kruger National Park, where we have a complete overlap in where elephants, a specific group of elephants will find themselves during the dry and the wet season. We've given them water, they sit in the same spot throughout the year. The plants, the vegetation never get time to recover. That's what I mean by them responding to a farming. Let me show another one. Let me move a little bit further away. Let me move to Namibia in this case and look at three different populations. And every one of the red arrows there shows you when we have done something, when we've either put water in or when we have put sensors in. And in response to that, you see the line connecting the number of elephants in that specific place. And time and again in these three cases, you see every time to the right upper line, an increase in the number of elephants in that given area after we've done something. We put in more water, we have more elephants. We put on sensors, we have more elephants. When you listen to me at this, and you look at all this information that I'm presenting to you, I think it becomes quite evident and clear that what is causing that apparent problem is quite well known. Do you want to fix this problem? Why don't we go for the cause? Now, we all have coffee and something to eat. Imagine you sit in this little plane. You're flying at 160 kilometers per hour, that's 100 knots. You're sitting 300 feet above ground, and about 1 square kilometer of land is passing below you every 3 seconds. Your responsibility is to count the number of elephants you see. With your permission, I would like to challenge the number of people in the house now to spend 6 seconds to count the number of elephants we will see in the next slide. It would be nice if you can then ask the people how many elephants they have seen by counting them, and we'll then control that number. So the next slide for 6 seconds, as you are having double the amount of time that a scientist will have in that plane. I do know that. It's time. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. How many elephants have you seen? 20, 15, 16, 18, 14, 17. Do you see what we are getting? We are picking up a lot of variation. Let's go there and count the number of the other lines. There are 22 elephants. So in-house here, a group of intelligent people, we have more than 50% of variability around the actual number, because we have 13 and 14 being called out as well. One of the most difficult tasks in the world is to find out how many elephants are living in any given space. As a matter of fact, they are so bad at it, when one of my students looked at all the surveys that have been conducted in Africa, and that means 2,600 of them over the last 440 years on 620 populations, we found that most of them were very inaccurate. And as you can see, the accuracy is focusing actually around 50 and worse, even 200% of variability around the actual number. It's very difficult to know how many elephants you are. Just think how arrogant we are then to say, there are too many or too few in any place. So other problem with elephants is that to a large extent we've allowed the media to dictate to us what is the problem. And this kind of is the imagination, or this is an image that fits the mass of the public. There must be too many elephants. How can we claim that there are? And the other image that we do have is this one of the poor minister having to take a decision on to apply a specific method. I think we are pulling ourselves. Now that we know what the problem is, why can't we find a solution? I'm going to offer to you one potential solution. Please allow me the time for that. Please allow me the time for that also when we realize that extreme options mask reality. When we have two extremes of solutions, we will never really get to a real solution because we have the extremes fighting all the time and nothing happening in the sense the way it's supposed to happen. The minister called the science round table in November 2005, we started meeting in February 2006. We got together and we had to tell the minister what's the real issue. I think the minister, like many, many politicians and many of us, rely on it that scientists will disagree. For when they disagree, no decision needs to be taken, and we can always claim that scientists disagree. The problem, however, is that we did not disagree. We actually agreed. And what did we agree on? One of the things that we did agree on is that elephants, when they are confined, can have an influence on the composition and structure of the ecosystem. And I'm illustrating to you one ecosystem here, the Itosha one. On the right is the Itosha with elephants. On the left you see a block without elephants. It's obvious what the difference is. The most obvious difference is the number of trees and bushes. Who is to say what is right? Is it very good to have many bushes? 50% of scientists will tell you no. Is it very good to have few bushes? 50% of scientists will tell you no. It's a decision that's taken on something else in science. The reality is when you have elephants, you will have some broken trees. However, what they also told the minister, we couldn't find a single study or evidence to indicate that any of the changes that elephants are making in systems cannot be reversed. They are all reversible, and over time, things change. The other thing they had to agree is that our state of knowledge at the time was imperfect. I mean, as scientists, of course, we have to keep ourselves going and we have to say that we have to do more work. It is surprising to me as a scientist working with elephants for a few years now to see how much our understanding of elephants has changed over the last 4 and 5 years. As a matter of fact, over the last 2 years have been revolutionary in our understanding of elephant societies and of elephant dynamics and elephant populations. And we really are starting to see the elephant as a completely different species than to what we were made out to believe for such a long time what it is. It was pretty easy, therefore, for the minister to get together and his departments and come up and draft norms and standards and suggest that the most obvious way to deal with the problem is to deal with range manipulation. And I explained to you when we farm with elephants, we are modifying the range. And if we can do something about it, we can do something about the problem. Removal and transportation, introduction of elephants, all of this is all news to you, ultimately down to contraception and culling. I want to deal with range manipulation because I think that is the ultimate solution. Apparently, there's a paradox, there's an understanding that we can deal with the elephant problem because two slides left. One, two. Absolute affection. A young brother saying to his older brother, "Hi, I've seen you before." There's no fighting there. That's friendliness and kindness. It's part of that very complex society and that social system. It's like me getting to you and tapping your shoulder and saying, "Good to see you, buddy." Those that came up with solutions in the past thought that as elephant numbers increase, the impact increases. It's therefore obvious that they came up with the idea that should we reduce elephant numbers and go to the left, we will reduce impact. That's the old school of thought. We don't know, we know that that is not the way that things operate. And they actually know that if we reduce the natural use of space, so the less the natural space as we go to the right of the axis there, the greater the impact. So the more artificial the system, the more part officially managed to management, the breaker will be the intact. So to fix it up, let's naturalize the space, and we'll solve the problem. Something as simple as that. As a scientist, I will be irresponsible not to have a proper model to explain to you how it works. Imagine now in space, the vertical line there being where there are no difference between the number of animals moving in and the number of animals moving out. And the horizontal one, where there's no difference between the number of animals born and the number of animals dying. So at the point where the two lines cross there, the population will not change at all. In real space, in nature out there, elephants are arranged along that orange line, like this. We have some populations, those in the far right, that green dot in the far right, where those populations are maintained by a very high birth rate and low death rate. And those to the far left are maintained by a lot of animals moving in there from these other places, all these populations being connected, so that the total population's change is that of a meter population, where the actual change over time is just about zero. How do we get this? We connect all these populations into a singular space, which we call a megaparsec. So we have meter dynamics within a megaparsec context. This is not a boring science behind it. This is the kind of things I have to defend in publications amongst my peers, which we've been doing for the last 2 years. This is the kind of model that's now being accepted as the foundation on which to build the actions that governments need to take to do something about managing the elephants. How do we study this? We covered across the subcontinent, we put satellite study sites with all these red circles, we put satellite collars on lots of elephants, we follow in these elephants and what they do daily and hourly, we interpret in terms of the environment, in terms of people and all these things. We've gone out, we've got the ages of about 11,000 elephants in 15 populations across Africa. We've looked at the data for about 620 populations in towns, and we interpret all these information, so try to provide it to you within the domain of this model that I've now illustrated to you. Some of the most important findings. This is the distribution of the number of elephants per square kilometer and the number of populations that you find. The point I want to make here is the black line here represents the scenario in the Kruger National Park. The number of elephants per square kilometer. It's about 0.5, 8.6. And all the others are presenting elephants in many other places. The point I'm trying to get to is there's no typical number of elephants in any given place. The number of elephants in any given place are varying all the time across space and across time. Most important thing for elephants is that numbers are changing. That story that elephant numbers are always on the increase is actually a bit of a figment of the imagination. And when you go and see what's happening in nature, we see that independent if you are in a very dry area or in a transitional area or in a wet area, you will have populations that are stable. In other words, the numbers are not changing. You will have populations that are increasing. And you will have populations that are decreasing. So right across southern Africa, of which we are part and parcel, we are either increasing or decreasing all stable elephant numbers. It's not true that all elephant numbers are on the increase across the subcontinent. We know why. We know that the more the number of elephants in any place, the lower the rate at which they reproduce. The time that what they become sexually mature becomes later and later in life, the more the number of animals on a given site. As well as the time between calving increases as the number of elephants are in effect. So there are some mechanisms inside elephant populations that are actually operational when given the opportunity, which allows numbers to stabilize. The other thing that we do know very well for elephants now is that the more variable the rainfall, the more the extreme, the more the drought, the lower your likelihood to survive. So if you're living in an environment that's very variable in rainfall, and you and I know that now with climate change, the big thing for southern Africans to the distribution range of elephants is that climate will vary more. We'll have more drought and more very wet periods. Elephants respond to that by reducing their survival. More of them die during drought. Putting that reproduction that's limited by numbers and survival that's limited by rainfall, by drought, together, and you understand why some elephant populations in reality stabilize. If you interfere, if you provide water, and you stop this effect of rainfall, then you will have numbers increase. If you put up fences and you stop elephants from moving to other places, then they will destroy the land. It's those kind of interferences that you need to manage. Not the thing that we call numbers, which we do in any case know very little about. That's what happened in the Kruger National Park. We all often complained about the Kruger National Park. Here, I put up one of my students to look at the 35 landscapes of the Kruger. On the right-hand side, you see a map with the different landscape types, the broad vegetation types of the Kruger National Park. And on the left, you see how numbers have changed over the 8-year period since the end of culling. And what you see is the red line is a typical rate of increase of about 5.5% per year, the average for the population. But you see there are many landscapes on which the increase is minus 20 per year. So there are landscapes on which numbers are all the time decreasing. As well as there are landscapes where the numbers are increasing at very high rates, at about 30% per year. How is this happening? Elephants and Kruger are moving from one land to another land all the time to give you this kind of dynamic across space. And in doing so, we are having the population actually functioning as a spatial entity. Let me even illustrate it even better now. This is the end of the Kapiti, this red tip, the end of the Kapiti, and the red document on the map there happen to be 6 elephants on which we have placed satellite collars last year in November. The yellow dots is where those elephants found themselves daily in the 6 months that followed on November, in other words, up to the end of June. And I think it must be very clear to you that those 6 elephants that we thought were Namibian elephants were actually spending most of their time in Angola, Zambia, and Botswana. The point I want to bring across here is that given this natural environment or semi-natural environment, elephants are not confined to one population. They are mixing all over the place. They don't have passports. They are moving, and when they are moving at free will, we are not getting the impact that we want so dearly to manage. So my point, Mr. Chairman, is that elephant numbers vary across space and time. The dynamics of the populations differ across space, and movements occur and could drive the dynamics of elephants, and we have to provide for this. The model that I've given to you makes sense as far as I'm concerned, and our publications and the acceptance of our publications actually is support for that. It makes ecological, social, political, as well as economic sense when you think of it. It overcomes the management errors of the past. Let's vary the past here as well. We've made some mistakes. There's no point in hammering those mistakes. Let's correct them. But to me, more importantly, if we are to apply this, we have an attempt to unify conservation efforts across the subcontinent. South Africa stands to be a leader in this. We can make a difference by having an approach that's different. The first step in the right direction is the statement. Is that first point, that first Buddha, the Satya. We need to explain and understand this one properly. We need to continue to research that one properly. And we need to set our objectives and our aims very clearly. It's completely in line with what's happening on the ground in terms of the Peace Park Foundation ideology, which is on the map here, coffee table book map. But it's the idea of putting land together so that natural dynamics can take over. We move from a very old approach from taking a discrim when they have a toothache to go to a dentist and fix the tooth. We move from symptomatic to perceived. We stop to see the population as a threat because it reproduces. We rather see it as a spatial entity. We change from populations to meter populations and habitats. and they move a full cell from captive breeding, contraception, culling and conservation to developing space and landscape opportunity, including people. So what I'm putting in the diagram to you here is we move from the left, from being symptomatic in our responses to being systemic. We reduce our management intensity along this line, and we see the efficiency of our conservation increasing along the red line. And where these two lines cross, we're actually seeing a viable system. In scenarios where we are on the far right, far left here, we'll have to fence off trees to protect them maybe from elephants. We maybe have to contraceive elephants. We maybe have to change water wells and think of culling and hunting and all this. When we move to the complete right, we have megafauna, we have meter populations, we have corridors, we have community involvement. We have true conservation. If we are citizens and supporters of the biodiversity and all these other ideas and wonderful ideas in life, it's at this far right end where we are really making a contribution. At the far left, we are busy with our farming practices and we will always be busy interfering. As a species, it's our responsibility to interfere in a very responsible manner. I'm the one that would prefer this adaptive and systemic rather than reactive and symptomatic approach. I would consider rather the causes of the problems than the symptoms. And I'd like to take this for change. The slide that you see there is not a pond of rotting algae on a river that's not alive. It's actually the swamp in Amboseli. And those little black dots there are elephants. They are round and obese. They are having a good life. The one population of elephants that I've experienced over these years that have not been interfered with, and I've seen nature continue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Professor Van Hart. I think before we take questions, we'll move on to the next presenters, who will be from Trustees of Animal Rights for Africa. Durant, if you give us some light back.
While my eyes adjust to the changed light, I think that what we heard from Professor Van Arde is very encouraging to us in Animal Rights Africa. We've been propagating the approach to elephant management for many years, going back pre-1995, which, with due respect to Professor Van Arde, and it certainly is something he has also been propagating, a more constructive, a more humane way of dealing with the problem. And I think that over the years when we've campaigned against culling elephants as a solution to sea problems, we were always told that there wasn't scientific evidence to back it up. Well, in spite of the ethical argument that we present as being the one that we really stand strong on, it's now very encouraging to see that science is leaning our way and that elephants are scientists of repute and standing who are fighting their fight for them, not necessarily as individual animals, but for the role that they play within the environment and the need to treat them with respect and allow them to play the constructive, positive role in the environment that they do. I'd just like to start off, and then Michelle will carry on, and then I'll pick up from her a bit later. It needs to be stated at the outset that the argument in favor of culling is based on the false premise that there are currently too many elephants. It's our contention that there is no scientific argument using the overpopulation fallacy which supports culling. There's absolutely no proof that of any population of elephants either in Kruger or elsewhere in South Africa. Hence, there can be no justification to cull at any stage. When people cite breakouts from parks, Kruger specifically, as evidence of overpopulation, this is totally unsupported by facts. Elephants leave Kruger and other and enter the community lands and private reserves along the Kruger because fences are deliberately breached by people wanting to hunt the so-called problem animals, or because fences break due to poor maintenance. Address these factors and elephants will not become the so-called problem animals that need to be culled and killed. The conflict does exist, it can be mitigated in a compassionate way, in a win-win way, that actually benefits communities and at the same time does not include labeling elephants as problem animals and killing them. Where there is a will, there is a way, and it is incumbent upon the draft norms and standards to provide frameworks for humane conflict mitigation and for educational projects and programs. It is our considered opinion that the call to cull is motivated purely by commercial interests, such as ivory and by the bloody-minded hunters who stand to derive pleasure and profit from being allowed to kill elephants. The local and global public will not tolerate this.
Humans typically do not see animals as they really are, sensitive, intelligent, complex living beings that suffer and die at our hands with no hope of relief. Now that South Africa has attained its freedom from political oppression, we have many other challenges. One of them is to make our society a kinder and more humane place. To that end, we need to learn to live in harmony with our environment and purge the violence that continues to affect our society, not only in our human community, but also in our relationship with the non-human animals who share this planet with us. Might is not right, and power over the weak does not give us the right to exploit the weak, but is rather an obligation to protect and assist them. Currently, humans are treating elephants no better than white people treated black people during the colonial and apartheid eras. We see the comforting web of lies that humans spin to justify species oppression, that elephants are stupid, that they don't really suffer the way we do, that they exist solely to serve our ends. The same web of falsehoods and propaganda that whites once wove around blacks and men continue to weave around women. And to add insult to injury, the victims cannot plead their own case. They cannot describe their suffering or show us how their world looks and how we appear from within the slave quarters to which we have confined them. The truth is that cutting spreads terror from air and land, breaks apart families and causes acute distress over a long period of time and over generations of families and clans near and far. We can hear and sense the fear, panic and slaughter of their fellow beings. There is a need to reimagine the issue of our relationship with elephants and move away from our historic culture of killing, where pulling out a gun is seen as the easiest solution. Like humans, elephants have complex minds and social structures. This is an indisputable fact, backed up by a huge body of evidence. And it requires that any policy document in relation to elephants must, at the very least, acknowledge that they have moral standing and that we have a duty of care towards them. On the occasion of the publication of the draft norms and standards for elephant management, Minister von Schalkwyk emphasized the following points: that DEKE is committed to finding solutions that are fair to elephants, that the principles that inform the decision-making process will display respect for elephants, that ethical dimensions will be included, that the management process shall be conducted ethically, humanely, and rationally, and that willful cruelty to animals must be condemned and avoided at all costs. The guiding principles of the norms and standards also acknowledge that elephants operate within highly socialized groups, that they have charismatic and iconic status, and that they are sentient beings. DEKE thus understands that the culling of elephants should be approached differently from other interventions. Given this, it is clear that elephants cannot and should not be viewed or classed as renewable natural resources, similar to oil or meat. However, in its present form, the draft norms and standards is still hopelessly inadequate in the way that it deals with and refers to culling. Moreover, of deep concern to us is the fact that it actively transforms complex social beings as mere things, resources, and commodities. Government must abandon the speciesism that clouds its mind with double standards and begin to think in a logically and morally consistent way. For just as a substantive grounds for culling overpopulating humans to conserve biodiversity are overridden by ethical considerations, exact same reasoning applies to the case of allegedly overpopulating elephants. We approach both cases with ethical, not ecological principles, with compassion, not indifference, and with non-violence rather than violent means. Moreover, ample management tools that exclude culling and killing are already available to conserve biodiversity. The South African conservation system was conceived during the periods of colonialism and apartheid and the sets of authoritarian norms of those eras. These were landscapes that produced both human and other animals as victims. The practice of culling is thus grounded in these mediums of control. Why would our government now merely adopt the old practices of the previous regime? Killing elephants using the too many overpopulation arguments is ecologically meaningless. It has been irrefutably shown that using numbers and population size as a means on which to base decision-making is fallacious. This is true for large and small reserves. If one examines the history of culling elephants in South Africa, it is manifestly clear that it was never about science or protecting ecological systems. For example, even when there were only 2,500 elephants in the Kruger National Park, authorities said there were too many and that they should be culled. Above all else, culling is a farming practice, and culling targets are therefore devised to seek economic targets and have no scientific basis. The practice of culling and the ivory trade are inextricably linked. Along with slaves, gold, and rubber, the allure of ivory drew Europeans to Europe's shores, to Africa's shores, and played a major role in some of the darkest chapters of white colonial rule on this continent. The colonial and post-colonial desire for ivory spurred the exploitation of not only elephants, but Africa itself. The demand for the coveted commodity massacred the elephants in Africa and turned these intelligent living beings into mere trinkets. The apartheid regime also profited from the ivory trade and used it to fuel the apartheid war machine. No wonder that culling was initiated in South Africa in the mid-1960s, at a time when the ivory trade was brisk and unchecked. Consequently, the factors that inform decisions to kill elephants are colonial, apartheid, and farming type mindset. Profit cannot be used as a justification to kill elephants. In addition, the concept of sustainable use cannot be taken in its most shallow sense and then applied across the board. We are sure this is not what policymakers are aiming at when it comes to developing the policy on elephants. We are equally sure that policymakers recognize that this kind of naked utilization position is totally inappropriate within the current democratic dispensation. Deep policy and attitude towards whales has reflected this and has, as a result, set a precedent for its policy and attitude towards elephants. It is ironic that those currently in favor of reinstating culling are the same people who criticized the rationale for the 1995 moratorium by calling for a more scientific approach, but are now downplaying the role of science in the debate. This is a deliberate manipulation where those in favor of culling expediently and dishonestly use creationist science as a reason to kill elephants, but when in the post-apartheid period this argument is scrutinized and criticized, the goalposts removed and the defense then became about values. The fact is that there are many different values to consider, including those of compassion. The existence of a plurality of values that are often in conflict does not mean that the sustainable use of each should automatically triumph. The future of elephants as individuals and as a species cannot be left up to the market to decide. To elaborate on this point, landmines have a definite military utility, but humanitarian consequences have outweighed their use and have resulted in a global ban on production and use. The norms and standards cannot give carte blanche license to those who want to treat elephants in any way that advances their economic interests. Elephants are not tools or objects or unworthy and unfeeling brutes. Surely the norms and standards cannot endorse such a value system. A moral framework must inform decisions, and it is not enough to say values play a role. What is crucial is what informs those values, how legitimate are they, and what consequences do they have. The value of sustainable use does not provide a moral framework in which an unjust war on elephants can be waged, particularly when other more reasonable and justifiable responses are available, rather than taking the drastic decision to go to war. The deep and rich emotional, psychological, and social lives of elephants, including their feeling of altruism and friendship, aggression and fear, are scientific facts that cannot be ignored. They exhibit skills and qualities such as good leadership, good communication, clear roles, cooperation, consensus building, respect for one another, and reconciliation. Like every human person, elephants have lives that are inherently valuable to themselves and important to their families and communities. And like humans, they are also subject to the life. One factor that has moved decisively against the coming of elephants is the research work of field biologists, psychologists, and ethologists. As a result, we now know that culling practices affect elephant society profoundly. This understanding of who elephants are has given rise to widespread public affection and recognition for elephants both locally and globally. Removing members of elephant family groups through culling and hunting means a loss of cultural information and has a major and irreversible disruption of their social complex network. One of the long-term consequences of culling will also be that the average age of the matriarch will decrease, and there will be fewer larger breeds and an ever-increasing number of smaller breeds led by younger and younger females. Culling and hunting, because of the loss of kinship and matriarchal information and experience, traumatizes elephant breeds and clans for decades and also results in unpredictable and dangerous behavior. Elephants are also our living heritage and our cultural and historical assets. South African heritage has been dominated by the colonial and apartheid legacies which have fixated on hierarchical domination and distinctions of superiority and inferiority. Through various heritage programs, position papers, policy formulation and international treaties, South Africa is taking seriously its reconnection with past African values. This redressing of past injustices and the decolonization of South African heritage also includes the way animals are treated. Our attitude to elephants must incorporate this reinvigoration of African ethics, which emphasizes interconnectedness, harmony, respect, tolerance, ubuntu, and ecological integrity. Killing animals for sport and culling is un-African. Culling is not an African practice or tradition, but an imposed colonial and apartheid subversion, which along with similar aberrations has negatively impacted on the African landscape and tradition.
Significantly, elephants are also part of South Africa's intangible cultural heritage. Elephants have their own communities, and there are negative impacts on elephant society if we merely treat them as renewable resources. Elephants are, in a very real sense, an intellectual, emotional, and spiritual community. They have their own heritage and their own languages, knowledge, and social practices that must be preserved. If the sole focus of African orientation to elephants is on economics rather than ethics, on what benefits humans, not animals, it is crucial to emphasize that there is far more economic value and gain in ecotourism. Elephants already more than pay their way through local and foreign tourism, and their presence has enormous benefits for communities who live near reserves where elephants live. Benefits to rural communities can indeed be derived from elephants, from reserves, but there's no prerequisite that this must involve consumptive use of elephants. Indeed, non-consumptive use is the most economically sustainable approach because it builds local capacity and infrastructure, increases skills, and creates financial self-sufficiency and independence while minimizing the potential harm done by killing elephants. Culling alienates tens of millions of Western tourists who will take their travel dollars elsewhere if they learn that South Africa has revived the despicable practice of culling. Since elephants are worth more alive than dead, ecotourism is a far greater economic resource than any perceived gain or saving through hunting and culling. The culling of elephants for any reason is indefensible, employs disproportionate force, and cannot be scientifically, ethically, or economically justified.
Moreover, culling and its effects ecologically, behaviorally, and on human elephants risk conflict will require very costly human intervention over extensive periods of time. Managers responsible for conservation areas frequented by elephants in any numbers must be compelled to manage the elephant populations using the other very viable non-lethal options already available. The case for removing culling as a management option is compelling. And we say this because we have taken a very strong stance in trying to convince the minister that the norms and standards must exclude the term culling completely, and that a management plan for elephants must be based on the factors already mentioned, the non-lethal, very viable factors. Culling is so onerous that it needs to be treated in isolation. That is, culling must be treated completely separately from the other so-called management options in the toolbox. Culling is a bad management practice. Once the floodgate of culling has been opened, it will be very difficult to control or halt it. There has never been a case where killing or culling elephants resolves a perceived threat to biodiversity. The negative consequences of culling are likely to persist for more than 100 years. Culling decisions are largely profit-driven, which not only have no ecological basis, but also lead to the fudging of data and the push for increasing culling quotas. Culling disrupts population dynamics and causes eruptive population growth, the very thing culling is supposed to address, which creates long-term problems and sets up a process of continual human intervention. To use a highly problematic and damaging intervention such as culling to try and fix the problem caused by this highly problematic and damaging intervention is irrational. Culling will not change the state of ecological systems and will not reverse trends, the very reason why culling is supposedly proposed in the first place. Culling elephants keeps the population density high, so that they are at a maximum sustainable yield. In addition, at lower densities, population growth may increase, so culling could effectively increase growth rates. Where elephants have been removed, their space is filled by other elephants or by competing herbivores. Point made by Professor Van Harder earlier. Selective culling targets both bulls or animals of certain age classes, distorts age structures, and enhances rather than suppresses growth rates. It then negates the intention of culling. Culling has severe behavioral consequences on the elephants left behind. This raises a red flag for both elephant-human interaction in the future, as well as for the welfare of elephants. Simply put, there is no urgency. Elephants are not irreversibly threatening ecosystems or human existence, and elephant management policy should be aggressively proposing alternatives to culling and going to extraordinary lengths to avoid violent responses. To employ culling as a methodology and solution, knowing what we know in this modern day and age, scientifically, ecologically, and ethologically, is simply not appropriate. The science factor. There is a huge flaw of the Minister's scientific roundtable process, and that was that no one was given an opportunity to make a case against culling being included as a management tool. It does seem that culling was included in the management toolbox for political and economic reasons, as there is no scientific reason for it being there. Given the major implications and sensitivities in relation to culling, this is tremendously problematic, if not outrageous. Much of the science that supports culling is anecdotal. Because of its burdensome and risky consequences, culling cannot be included as an option merely because some people think there may be a reason to cull one day, or because some managers are so immersed in the culling mindset that they see this as a so-called solution to a perceived problem. To reiterate, there is absolutely no evidence of an imminent risk to biodiversity in relation to numbers of elephants as they are at present. Adaptive management cannot be interpreted as shooting elephants first and seeing what happens to biodiversity later. This is not only unscientific and goes against ecological processes, but also has serious ethical dimensions that cannot be ignored. No scientific or ecologically justifiable justification exists to cull or hunt elephants. Simply put, the supposed scientific and ecological reasons put forward by some managers for culling are flimsy and weak and do not stand up to interrogation. The culling of elephants is in direct violation of the interests of individuals. In the community of those who are concerned with the welfare and the interests of animals, locally and internationally. The effect of culling may also involve significant tourist boycotts for South Africa, thus impacting negatively upon social and economic development of the community surrounding the reserve. Culling elephants does not create conditions for sustainable tourism. The knock-on effect of culling elephants will be against these strategic plans to increase the annual volume of international tourists visiting South Africa. Elephants are one of the key reasons why tourists visit our country each year, creating jobs and alleviating poverty. The global public has made it clear that it does not want to see elephants being culled. If culling is reintroduced, it will send a disturbing message to the world about South Africa's attitude to wild animals, and towards elephants in particular. This will have dire consequences for tourism, something South Africa can ill afford, particularly in the run-up to FIFA World Cup in 2010. The norms and standards need to become to promote ethical conservation. It should endorse and support compassionate, humanitarian, humane elephant conflict resolution measures, assist local communities in ways which bring real lasting benefits to people without killing elephants. To include culling as an option under the guise of development and poverty alleviation is disingenuous and unsustainable. It is simply wrong to argue that the only way rural communities can benefit from conservation is if the animals pay with their lives. This is not a long-term option for poverty relief or for sustainable livelihoods. Poverty alleviation programs need to be designed that avoid animal suffering and take into account respect for other species. Killing elephants cannot be maintained at a rate that will bring sustainable development to rural communities. To base population reduction on elephant products will create expectations and dependencies, which will sooner rather than later run counter to conservation objectives, while at the same time fail to deliver sustainable social development to the community. And I think I'd like to add something in here, and it's a point we've made during many discussions we've had on the attitude of black people in South Africa to animals, and not only in South Africa, throughout Africa. If you look at the campfire project in Zimbabwe and similar projects elsewhere, there seems to be an attitude that black people only respect animals if they have a financial economic value. And I think that that is an insult to black people, that they should be judged to only be interested or care about animals if they can make some money or make a livelihood out of them. The elephant back safari industry is a rapidly growing elephant industry in South Africa, with increasing numbers of elephants being captured, tamed, and trained. These elephants are then supplied to local and international zoos, circuses, and elephant back safari operators. Animal Rights Africa is totally against the forcible removal of young elephants from their families in the wild and taking them into captivity for training. This practice is unacceptable, cruel, and unethical, and has been condemned by internationally renowned elephant behavioral specialists, animal ethologists, and is contrary to international norms. Even the Kruger National Park has, since 1998, taken the decision that the transportation of juvenile animals is, quote, inhumane and therefore undesirable, unquote. South Africa is currently faced with the challenges of trying to rein in the hugely unethical camp and trophy hunting industry. Is the minister going to wait until the elephant industry grows, follows the same unethical route before questioning the validity and ethics of the tame and trained elephant industry? In closing, we do not believe that sufficient thought has gone into the formulation of an elephant management policy planned for South Africa that does not include culling as an option. Elephants occupy a special place in the hearts of but a few. Unfortunately, it is these two who have until now dominated the formulation of policy relating to elephant management. This is a group that does not care about individual elephants dying. but many do care. And it is not only animal rights who call for the abandonment of elephant management policies that permit the gratuitous killing of elephants. We challenge the South African government to apply its mind to this issue and to develop an elephant management plan which completely excludes culling as an option. Thank you.
I thank you for both your thought-provoking presentations. I would like to be guided by the members as to whether do we get the department to respond to both presentations before we put our questions to them. I think that would be rather the best way of handling the situation.
To allow the department to continue to frame from the point of view of norms and standards what civil society is. But many of our feelings are strong.
Even though on the line.
last presentation, I did hear them talking or talking about certain aspects which were left out of the norms and standards of the department, if I'm not mistaken. However, we was then used to what you said, which is somewhat what Machama had said, that perhaps let's have a few questions, and then thereafter we'll get the department to make their presentation on norms and standards, and then we would then have further questions and clarities on the issue. Thank you. Dr. Kachalia, Machama, Dr. Mugwena, Morgan, and that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presenting. The first question is regarding to the greater Limpopo Transhumance Care Park, which was signed into existence, I believe, in 2002. Now, Zimbabwe's socio-economic and political problems have been a stumbling block to its development. The Zimbabwe section of the park is called Honorizo, I think, appears to be more of a liability than a help in securing funds from donors. What are the long-term implications for the sustainability of this farm? And the second question is, how do you overcome threats to communities living adjacent to elephant populations? And the third question is contraception viable or a non-viable option? What is the thinking behind either option? Thank you very much.
Before you respond, perhaps maybe you need to note the questions and then we take all of them at the same time. I had said Dr. Kachalia, Machama, Dr. Mugwena, and then Garrett, and then Mantuli would be last. I don't know whether you had an opportunity to note some of the first questions from Dr. Kachalia.
Mr. Chairman, as an academic, I have major shortcomings. I have ability to concentrate for a very short time, and I would love to produce some per individual. We've heard delightful questions, and I'd like to respond to those immediately, rather than having 10 questions, and I can assure them I will not be able to respond to any.
If you wish.
Thank you. On the first question, a very exciting development. Considering that park and its full development will cover a land of 105,000 to 120,000 square kilometers. That means a fivefold increase in the effective size of the Kruger National Park. Political, socio-economic stumble blocks are realities that comes and goes. The conservation and maintenance of biodiversity is a reality that needs to be maintained throughout all of those. And we need the scientists to come up with original plans to politicians, economists, and sociologists to overcome these. Let's look at the reality and the responses to what has been happening there already. The 50% increase in the effective increase in the size of the Kruger National Park by including the land on Mozambique's side, the 10,000 square kilometers on that side, has seen the elephant population there increasing from about 42 within 5 years to 660 now. Kruger National Park's Director of Conservation, Hector McCormick, called me last week in my office to report to me there are now a bit of a problem, for there are fewer elephants this year in Kruger National Park than the previous year. I'm delightful by the problem. The dynamic is coming into action. Kruger is in the process of closing its own water holes, at the same time effectively removing the fence, and we're seeing a complete change in the dynamic. The advent of starting this transfrontier with a television production where Mr. Mandela offered 24 elephants to his new bride, of which most returned within 6 weeks back to the Kruger National Park, cost in television production and so on and the cost of moving those elephants at the time in the region of 7 million rand, generated within a year 57 million euros in support of conservation for that area. The international funding and the lobbying are there. It's our responsibility to create a bit of political stability, and that is the scientist I cannot offer a plan for yet. They vying from our neighbours into this program and this project that we're conducting, because I'm working on the elephants all the time as well. As a matter of fact, I'm in a very fortunate position also to have been in the SRT and to serve the properties of the Department of Environmental Affairs, as well as at the same time serve the interests of, for instance, IFOR, as well as certainly working on the elephant assessment that is addressing many of the problems that we have listened to about cutting in this morning. The problem of elephants spilling over onto people's land and threatening people is a real issue. How do we deal with it? We've come up with a thought-provoking idea, such as planting chilies around their crops and houses, such as putting on electric lights and flash bulbs, and a horde of very creative ideas, none of which work when tested or going through a test the same, but all of which work according to those that have applied them. So it's case specific. In general, we've come up with the idea in southern Mozambique where we are fencing people in and elephants out. That is also applied in Niassa. Niassa up in northern Mozambique, where you use a single or double-stranded electrified fence, sun-powered, and put it up at 1.6, 1.7 meters. People can move freely, and elephants don't come in. There are ingenious ways of dealing with the trouble. There are ingenious ways of dealing with appeasement on both sides of the fence. It's not all just for elephants, it's about people as well as elephants. I hope I've addressed your interest in your question today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Oh, okay.
Sorry. I do apologize. I haven't addressed contraception. I apologize for that and for the intervention. I'm very happy to say I'm old enough to be arrogant enough to say that the idea of developing contraception for elephant was mine back in 1991 when as a biochemist, a reproductive biochemist, I started very actively in working on the elephant ovary, trying to block the activity of the ovary, came up with some ideas, had some other developments by veterinarians, some exciting developments. Today is much better than mine. And then for one moment, also had the good fortune of having to produce an ecological paper and say to myself, well, what will contraception do to solve the problem? It's very interesting. There are two aspects. How many elephants should I contraceive before I address my problem? Well, that means I have to address my problem. What is my problem? Well, my problem is elephants are breaking trees. I don't like them breaking trees. I want them to stop trees. Mr. Chairman, I can assure you that no animal, including humans, on a contraceptive stop to eat. I'm not addressing the problem. I'm addressing the issue. The issue is important. It's an ethical issue. Ethics is a reality of human society. We should recognize that. There are certain conditions under which elephants are kept. They are near zoological conditions. They are open parks. There are little places where elephants should in reality not be. There are places that are less than 10,000 square kilometers. There are people keeping elephants to entertain people. Where they don't want to have more elephants. The humane way to go around there could be to contraceive them at times, knowing that it will have consequences for the individual, social consequences that are not acceptable by all, and knowing very well it won't stop elephants from breaking the trees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My
gentleman.
Thank you.
Chair. I'm I fully agree with you that I think culling is a drastic and terrible
led an elephant park really well, and from a small town I've always been part of visiting the elephants, watching it grow, watching the differences there are between those elephants and elephants from other areas. I know it well and I love it, and those elephants have always been part of my life. And I don't think, quite honestly, that in general, globally one might even say, that people are unaware of the very, very special creatures that elephants are. They are a symbol of everything in a way that is, we anthropomorphize all animals, I think, to a certain extent, but they, to us, are creatures that have the peaceful family lives, caring of one another, the matriarch of society, all of that. And culling would be a shocking intrusion, and terrible also for the people who would have to do the culling. It's a violent and brutal option. At the same time, I think if the parks were only consisted of elephants, then maybe different options could be found. But they are, there are a multiplicity of other creatures in the park, many of them herbivores. And I get that Wildlife magazine, because I'm a member of WEDSA, and reading the letters from people who have been visiting the Kruger National Park all their lives, one of the constants amongst them is that there is an increasing loss of, and these are from scientists as well as ordinary families, the people who've been there, going there for the last 30, 40 years, that there's a decrease in biodiversity, and almost without exception, they tend to say there are too many elephants. The elephants are a major factor in the destruction in certain parts of the park of the natural environment, and that they are impacting to a serious extent on the other species that there are in the park. I mean, Professor von Arth would know far better than me, because he's very much part of looking at the problems and trying to find the solution. I'm interested to know what the story of the water holes. If you start removing the water holes, wherever there are water holes, surely that's where the animals less water holes. Would that mean, is that any kind of an answer? Are you saying that the water holes are only there in order for the tourists to congregate around them and to see the elephants and hopefully catch a kill or something like that? I don't quite get the rationale behind the removal of water holes. But wherever you have fences, you're going to have too many animals. I mean, the elephants have now no natural enemies, except the odd little calf gets taken by a lion. But there is no natural way of limiting their numbers. Certainly there are, like the kangaroo in Australia, there's a certain self-limiting aspect where they are less inclined to ovulate and become fertile in when there are bad times. But in general, when I look at Addo, and there are no restrictions there, and yet, fortunately, and the way those numbers have increased so substantially over the past 15 years, I mean, I think it's quite a nice thought that the elephants will limit their own numbers, but I'm not quite sure that that actually happens.
Thank you for those remarks. I'm going to deal with the water one first and then with the population one, if you don't mind. At the same time, I would like to deal with the statement that biodiversity in Kruger National Park is in the decline. This is also the source of a very well-respected scientific papers that actually shows that there are 11 large mammal species in Kruger that's presently on the decline. One needs to read these papers and study them properly to understand the mechanisms behind it. We know that a specific part of feet of land can hold so many species at any given time. That there is a specific relationship between the land area and the number of species that occupies that land. That relationship is for about 80% linear. What I'm saying to you, if you protect 80% of all land, you'll more or less protect 80% of all species indefinitely. You protect 60%, 60%, let's see how it goes. There's time lag, however. The time lag seems to be about 100 years in African savannah. So you set a piece of land aside, you capture a lot of species in that piece of land. You set aside of that biome maybe 10%. Ecological principles dictate that you will, over time, then you lose 90% of the species. This island biogeography is my workout theory that's very well applied and directly applied by ecologists. The reason for us losing species in Kruger presently is because we've isolated Kruger from ecological mechanisms that keep species going. Remember the diagram of mine, you flow from the one place to the other all the time. That we've cut Kruger off. We're now taking action to reverse that, and the consequences should be positive. My point about water is where you put water, animals will concentrate. When water started, when people started putting water into Kruger back in 1939, and the peak of putting water into Kruger was in the 70s, and the whole Pinot Gardens at the time, the whole idea was to spread the load right across the land. In other words, to have species to stop to concentrate on rivers in the dry season, but rather be all over the land. That's exactly what the species did. And now we're unhappy that they did that. That's what I meant by them responding very good to farming. Closing down waters, we know, reverse that process. We know from the accidental loss of water holes in certain parks, like the Mithosha National Park, like in Wongi National Park, we have an immediate response. Some very respected recent papers dealing with that topic. So I think we know what the response of animals are to being confined, to being isolated, to be put into small places. We know why we're losing species. We know it's not related to elephants. We know we have got ecological processes in action here, and we know how species respond to water. The thing that we have to remember that is very important about water. No, it's not necessarily for the delight of tourists. That's not really what it is. It's not a tourist that goes in the state where you put the water pump. It's a man that put the water in, that created where to put the water in. Elephants will stand and die in drought at water, as long as they're close to water with their babies. I've seen it. I've seen it in Karoo National Park in Namibia. The point about elephants limiting their numbers themselves suggested it's rather interesting one that I don't know. With all due respect, I would not make a statement in this house if we haven't had very good scientific evidence and published information that has been peer-evaluated and peer-reviewed on this specific point. We do know that every elephant that lived for about 60 years on average, longer than 60 years, 50 years on average, will experience 2 to 6 droughts in its lifetime if they live in a savannah. That means that every elephant before the age of 12 or 13 will have experienced a severe drought. If you're not supplying water, some of those elephants will die. It takes only 1.5% of your population to die to reduce your population's growth rate to about zero. That's it, that 1.5% are adult animals. 1.5% of your adult population dying, of animals that become adult to reproduce, you will have a 0% population growth. So we understand the response and how elephant numbers are limited by the environment. It's not limited by predation, it's limited by droughts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is that Demo Buena?
Yeah.
Chairperson,
seven points. Point is
speaking. I'd like to come and say that they must not adopt a laissez-faire attitude. Laissez-faire attitude means let's leave things to take care of themselves. You see, if you have to apply this to human beings, that means we need to be appropriate. But why are we here calling? We are here to try and manage human beings for the start. Then after this, we actually govern human beings. If you allowed that type of thinking of life and faith, then you can imagine what kind of life it will be on this planet that contains approximately 6 billion people. Human beings, highly sensitive beings, intellectual, et cetera. Those people, there is a need to actually regulate and manage them. So I follow that principle that you cannot adopt a laissez-faire approach and say, let me take from there, the people there. Because we're not going to do that. We are here for this parliament with all the mistakes. And, you know, we are supposed to be regulating, people of regulating, and we are also for our own thrones. We can learn how big the problem is. So at least we are trying to have some government. There must be government. However, there will be short sitting with that point. In governing ourselves, the planet and everything, we must make provision for a 50-50 type of situation, a balance. So that the one species that we put in the garden, there should be coexistence and there should be sustainability. And we indeed here, especially in the control committee, we espouse the concept of sustainability. Everything you do must not be excessive and must not be deficient. It must have a balance. If you fail to have a balance, then the equilibrium you have problems. So there must be 50-50. Following from there, we receive also from mining people, etc. and say, no, look, man, just allow us to mine everywhere. You see, this rock of Earth has got so many precious minerals, diamond, gold, you name it. And there are people that say, you just allow us. When we prospect and find a mineral, we must just dig. That's all. They say, oh, wait a minute. Not the aid, but we should know that. No. Please. You are actually the same. Now, the same applies to your very, very constructive, progressive lobby. You have identified this magnificent beast, the elephant. The Lord of Limit. Don't touch it. Let it take care of itself. I'm not using another point. The point is, you must avoid the danger of humanizing animals. Animals are animals. They are not become human beings. Just like human beings cannot become animals. But I read the kind of work, anyway, it was a good dog, and he'll tell you the tale of water, blood, and such a person. But you cannot humanize animals. And you cannot, because if you do that, then you also run the risk of deifying them. Just like you cannot make human beings become God. You can't. So don't humanize animals. And don't deify them. Treat them in the respect that they have. And, you know, accord them the spirit of and appreciate them for their utilitarian things. If you bring a sheep here or a cow here, chicken here, etc., you know, be afraid for their, you know, there's a little story, but there's a little fable of a kingdom that we are asking the importance. The chicken said, hey, you know, I'm such a good animal. I make sure every morning I lay eggs that my master will have food. So the bee said, huh, that's not enough. I actually lay my leg, I give up my whole life. Now, that means all animals are important. Right, good. Today, we can see one way about the rhino, one way about the crocodile. We didn't say anything. There are so many of these animals. So why would I say one animal just because of its size and say, look, now this one is a special case. It's so big that it must be close. What about the ways? And what about the other magnificent beasts? See, we must have equity, we must have balance. Because what's happening now, and the elephant was lucky. And because it attracted many rodents. What about the poor chicken? Somebody wants to spend an NGO day and say, save the chicken. Save the thing. Then we have all these rubbish here. And funding, and ultimately what's going to happen. But I'm not completely pushing now. And by saying, I think what should guide us all of us? Nobody should say, kill anyone. Nobody should say, kill the life. Kill. We should have a balance. If it is necessary to come and as a last resort, in a very controlled situation with all conservation, and as it's been clearly spelled out in the minister's proposal, we shouldn't actually say, no, that's not the scar work. Those are the wrong refined and remove those cars. Because when you say that, why, what is the right thing to call? We slaughter cattle. What is the right to just be dreamer and apostrophize this one? Why do you actually slaughter? We don't slaughter. Now, Kali is a euphemism. But it just shows that look, we're saying, look, if there are no problems, let's actually find the law. It's because nobody just wants to say, let us just kill them for the safety. I agree with you, it's wrong to kill them for commercial reasons of the innocent tasks and so on. That's absolutely wrong. Yeah. But I may give you what you can, because otherwise you won't be. To introduce a disequilibrium in the 50-50 thing, which will also be for the human beings themselves. Well, not for the human beings. But the idea is that 50-50 might be a balance on this planet. It might be a planet. You cannot just elevate one species to say, this is the fish world. What will happen right now? We're going to have a disequilibrium and we only have one environment. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Dimkwena, for your comment. I don't know if whether either of the presenters would like to respond on that. But one thing that I do know, what created this whole problem, it's the human population explosion. And the land that we see, they don't make it anymore. We are fighting for space. You know, that's where all the problems emanate from. But however, if anybody wants to respond on that, you have the floor.
I would like to respond very quickly and just explain this skewness of interest on elephants. To the house. The elephant is a mere flagship, an ambassador, a showpiece of our successes and our failures in conserving biodiversity. The world identifies much easier with an elephant than a frog or a butterfly. The principles that we have applied in my presentation this morning, I could have applied in a show-up in favor of the tree frog. I wouldn't really apply in favor of an argument to conserve chickens. The simple reason for that being, half opportunity for chickens to live feral and they will be gone. We've domesticated a few species over the last 10,000 years for very specific reasons. We shouldn't mix up our interests and our behaviors towards those species with those that are wild and are serving other specific purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that, response to what has been said here, there are a number of points that were made, specifically the first one regarding why elephants. Well, the animal rights movement doesn't differentiate between any species of animal on the planet, whether it's an elephant, or a mouse, or a whale, or a bat. There's no differentiation. We're talking about elephants today because this particular presentation concerns the draft norms and standards on the management of elephant populations in South Africa. And so it would be inappropriate to discuss elephants, at least whales, or chickens, or pigs, or anything like that. So please don't think for one moment that we are species selective in our concern for animals. Certainly we don't deify elephants. We don't put them above anybody else, or anything else. And I think that it might be appropriate at some stage for the mechanisms within Parliament to actually have an audience with an animal rights organisation such as ours. So I think there are many issues relating to animal rights which affect the society that we live in and which should be addressed at a much higher level than are currently the case. As far as culling elephants is concerned, I think Professor Van Arden encapsulated this morning arguments that have been put forward over a number of years now, and never as eloquently as he is doing it nowadays in his presentations, and as factually correct as he is doing it, that there is no need to kill elephants. And that the killing of elephants is based on gratuitous factors, such as the sale of ivory, the satisfaction of hunting bloodlust, and also the false economic promises made to communities around the park that they will benefit from elephant populations. I know from history that political parties promised people access to reserves so they could get their vote during the elections. These are things that have happened, and these have led to expectations which cannot be met, and which should not be met in an ethical society. The processes that lead to the culling of elephants are also not properly defined in the management of elephants as proposed in the draft norms and standards. They allow a situation where mere managers at provincial local level can make decisions about elephants' lives out of context with the general principles of the draft norms and standards, which means that somebody can be influenced by the high level of corruption which unfortunately exists in our conservation communities nowadays, where hunters pay money to management officials within conservation circles to say that we need to get certain numbers of elephants out of reserves because we're clients who need to shoot them. Where animals that break out of reserves are notified, and professional hunters who are appointed as the person to control problem animals in the province attend to that animal, and if it doesn't suit that person's need for a client who wants a particular animal, the person turns his back on it and leaves. So there are many factors that need to be taken into account here. Most importantly is that elephants do not need to be culled. More importantly is that we are not deifying them or basing our values or their interpretation of what elephants are on anthropomorphism. Many, many scientific studies have been done on elephants over the years, which have identified characteristics and traits in elephants. They are so uncannily close to those which we value in humans and which inform our management plan for humans that we ask that those factors be taken into account so that they may inform our management plan for elephants as well. No rational person sitting around this room today would propose lethal culling of human beings because, without a doubt, human beings have overpopulated this planet. Without a doubt, they cannot resolve the problems of overpopulation by moving through time and space, as Professor Van Arden has proposed, for elephants. The population of humans has gone beyond that. And we are not counting trees when we talk about human urban population. Nobody talks about the square kilometers by the million that are destroyed every year by human beings. We don't look at those trees and propose that we should cull in order to reduce dependency on the byproducts of forest desecration. So what we're asking is that we compare life with life, and that we develop a set of values which appreciates that which makes us like any other animal or any other animal like us. And I think it's important that we keep in mind that every reputable scientist in the world, including most of the people who sit in the hierarchy of churches, acknowledge that human beings too are animals. Thank you.
Thank you. Let us move in, and then Manju Lidell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot has really been covered, but I've got one specific question, and that is on the threat that animal rights advocates say there is of a tourist boycott. And I think it was stated that you thought there would be millions of people who would be outraged and want to visit South Africa. Firstly, what do you base sort of this imminent, what does it mean, the extent that you think the number of people will not want to visit South Africa on. What campaigns are already underway? And secondly, is Animal Rights Africa involved in this campaign? And if indeed culling happens, would you increase your involvement in it, if you already are?
Mr. Chairman, the first question was, what do we base the statements relating to tourist boycott on? There has been a poll done in Europe which has shown that substantial numbers of people will not come to South Africa if culling is reintroduced in South Africa. That's a poll which is done by a reputable company. We can get that information for the gentleman if he so wishes, but this is something that has been done. But going back to the 1995 moratorium on elephant culling in the Kruger Park, there was a poll done then as well, and since then many organizations internationally have spoken to various bodies which are at the forefront of organizing tourism to this country, the travel agencies and marketing companies. And in fact, during 1995, there was a conglomerate of marketing and travel companies that combined to support a decision for culling to be ceased, a cessation of culling in the Kruger Park, because they had feedback from their potential clients that they wouldn't want to come to South Africa. I think that this government itself is very aware of the impact of international boycotts. In fact, the government had no qualms in its previous guise as the liberation movement, calling for all kinds of boycotts to suit justifiable political and social objectives in this country. So we believe that when sufficient numbers of people feel strongly enough about something, they will act in a way which will encourage the perpetrators of those deeds to reconsider the ideas. We haven't, at this point in time, become involved in any effort to organize boycotts simply because we believe that the whole process is still in negotiation. And we have goodwill from governments regarding consultation and transparency, and that is why we are here today. It's part of a process, and we haven't come to the end of that process. And we are hopeful that the situation will play itself out in a positive and constructive way. So for us to take a stand of promoting tourism boycotts at this stage would be an act of bad faith. And we believe that we act in good faith at all times, and that we haven't yet even got close to looking at becoming actively and personally involved in tourism boycotts. Having said that, should we feel that decisions are being made which need to be reconsidered, and that the only way that they can be reconsidered is through non-violent action, civil disobedience, etc., then we will consider each and every one of those actions on its own merit and make a decision from there. Thank you.
Mantuli and then Manza.
The questions that I have been answered, I have concern about the last question of today. Again, I wanted to check if is there any season that is known for mating of elephants? If so, which season is then known for giving birth? And one other thing, towards the hobbies of black people. For instance, black people are known for hunting. And their hunting was, to me, as far as I understand, was very limited during such time. And you have white farmers who are hunting from time to time. I don't know how what you call that. It's the attitude of the black people towards animals, and if the white farmers are hunting, it's something. And not on the other side, so Rosie, I don't know. And really, because we are all citizens of this country, I think it is good to know the culture, the whole thing of certain people, they are doing our environment, etc., etc. Really, I would like to know if they are considered any research, how can how can animals can be utilized, I mean, for the growth of the economy of this country. Now, I am saying this question because I have that the lifespan of the elephant is between 50, and they say that and whenever we are facing this, it's when we are expecting the reduction of numbers of animals. Now, why should we will be observing that whenever they start, the elephant will be hunting? Why don't we have ways and means of using maybe animals economically other than maybe feeding the vulture? Because for me, if they are just killed by the start, it's for the vulture to snap themselves. I don't know whether I'm wrong. But you know, it is really they are confusing. I know the elephants are from part of the big fight, but the big fight. So the tourists, really, when they come, the first thing they talk about is the big fight of South Africa. That's the thing. But hence, the upside of these elephants is the feeling. What's the best way that we can utilize them? I mean,
thank you. I wonder if you would like to take the last two questions along with the very last one. In view of our time, we still have the department to make some presentation to us and further questions. And we have about 60 minutes left of that. Manza, can you ask your question and then Mazda Zidalala will be the last? But let's stay in mind that, you know, we have time constraints. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've only got one question, Chairperson. In fact, it's not a question, it's a matter of clarity. The presenter speaks about tourists not visiting South Africa if elephants are being killed. What puzzles me is that tourists don't just come to South Africa because they want to see animals. That is, I don't want to believe that. Because here in our country, we've got the wonders of nature that people from abroad come here to see. You've got the three roundabouts. That is the creation of nature. And people come here to go and view those roundabouts. And millions, thousands and thousands of people come to that place. We've got the gorge, Chairperson, we've got the gorge where our people can just go down. But because our people, the black people,
are not familiar with the sport. We are not, many of them want to play the sport. But tourists, the people who come from outside, they are the people who come there to come and go down and up and down. I know we've got people there, but not me. Up and down in that gorge. And besides the gorge chairperson, we have quite a number of people for the gorge window, where people can go there. Tourists, especially tourists from outside, they've never had such an opportunity. They've never had such a... they don't have those opportunities in their country. They don't have those three rendezvous. Now, why should Kenny be made for us? You know, is it a way of lobbying for our country to go back to colonialism? No, please, Chairperson. Our presenters should tell us why they are here, because Kenny is not the first time it was done during the apartheid system. It was done during the apartheid system, and we were against it as black people because we could not see the, you know, especially me, I did not understand that then. Elephant meat can be consumed by humans. And as a result, really, most of us, I can say some of us, were against the killing of animals so that we can obtain elephant meat. But now this one, about that. Please let me get the better explanation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, a lot has been asked and answered on behalf of the members. You know when you hear the last. No question. Well, listening to the second presentation, it was mentioned that tourism has contributed towards alleviation of poverty. But maybe it would be good if they can just expand a bit. Just tell us so that you can know. Right. You know, August of the month of the women. It was the women's month. And we're capitalizing on poverty eradication. Right. And I would really love to know how can we. And as far as I know, everybody will tell you about ivory. You know, when you have a necklace, ivory, yeah, you look smart and very expensive. Maybe the presenters can say something about the sheep or other parts of the elephant which can contribute towards the economy of the country. One other thing which I would like to know, because communities do visit the sun parks where there are animals and whatnot, you name all animals. My complaint is that at what stage are elephants dangerous towards people, towards especially those who visit when you are at the park? Because at a certain stage, I understand they can do good if you are not careful. It has been dealt with contraception. But I still don't understand how it is applied. Because with us, human beings, you are given tablets to take or injections, you know. There are quite a number of patterns that human beings apply when they are trying to contrast that. Elephants have quite a number of One of them is they trees, they interfere with people's houses, homes, whatever. Maybe they can, there are still other habits, you know. Thank you.
The floor is on both presenters if you want to respond, but bear in mind that we've got time on site. The department still has to make their contributions, and we still have our questions on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the questions. There's a lovely thing about elephants that I'd like to share with you. It's the number 12. Elephants start having babies when they're just about 12. They have just about 12 babies in a lifetime because they produce them on average at 4-year intervals, and then they die. Elephant cows stop to have babies when they're about 56. Of those 12 babies, 12 will be boys and 12 will be girls. The 12 boys will leave the mothers when they are just about 12 to join the other bachelors. And the girls will stay behind and at their age of 12 have their own again. It's a very interesting and very simple, very complicated society. Yes, they bred them for 22 months so that they will start mating at the time that the babies get produced when the grass is very green. It's a very interesting and educated development. Tourism, people coming to see elephants and the doubts about these things and so on. These are very interesting and complicated questions. You know, it's very exciting to know that there are probably more tourists coming to see birds than elephants. They love vultures. Elephants die, and you wonder why should we feed the vultures? Well, we are feeding ourselves because we are feeding and providing to the tourists. They're providing through elephants a very diverse portfolio. A lot of different things. It's wonderful to have mountains and gorges. It's wonderful to include elephants in those mountains and gorges as well. It's the diversity of life that excites people. People question numbers here. I went to a conference a while ago and I listened to some figures. Some 35 to 39% of economic activity in this country can now be ascribed to tourism. Only 8% to agriculture. Tourism is important. 70% of tourists coming to South Africa come to either see Table Mountain or the Kruger National Park. Yes, in between they will stop at your gorge as well, and you will benefit from them on their way either into or away from the Kruger National Park. This is a reality. South Africa is very special because we provide a very thick and comprehensive package. How do we apply contraceptives to elephants? The most humane way presently, where it's being assessed and tested, is to dart, put it in a dart that you are shooting into the animal from a helicopter. And you mark the animal at the same time, and then that animal will be considered as not being having babies. For about 6 months you cannot conceive, and then you will re-dart and you go on with the process, which in itself can be very expensive when put in a large operation. You need to put about 75% of your adult cows on a contraceptive to be effective to reduce the population. We have about...
How do you know if you are... That goes exactly to a female or to a male?
We know as scientists what a female looks like from the helicopter and the male. They look very, very, very different, okay? We can identify a female very easily. And we can then actually put that down to the animal. The people that do it, of course, I don't do it myself. These are qualified veterinarians that do it. But it can be done. We are busy producing a massive volume for the interests of society called the assessment of the elephant population. And we're producing this document to be completed in December with support from the Department of Environmental Affairs, the assessment of what the situation in elephants. And in this book, we are writing about how to apply contraceptives and how we are doing all these things. The last thing, Mr. Chairman, that I would like to address is this continuous misunderstanding that culling is a form of hunting. And now I'm going a bit beyond my own science. Culling has a specific definition in the dictionary. It's a form of killing to reduce numbers. Okay? Hunting is something very different. The establishment of conservation areas in Africa, as it specifically was motivated by stopping the settlers and the local people from over-hunting the animals to protect them for the crown. That was the specific motivation for it. So the way that one society is hunting and another society is hunting is one issue. That is the issue that is completely different to culling. The reasoning behind culling is something very, very different. And on that notion, I have to show you, or just share with you, something. I'm going to try to put it on the board immediately. It should go on now. In the days, early days of culling to the mid days of culling, 1967 to about 1974, there was an increase in the number of boreholes and waters for elephants in the Kruger National Park. And as an increase, we see at the same time an increase in the birth rate, about 3% increase in the birth rate, and about a 1.7% decrease in the death rate of elephants. At the time when culling was put in, when boreholes was also put in. In the middle section, when we put in even more boreholes, that we had a sudden drought that lasted about 5 years, we still see an increase in the birth rate, but a dramatic increase in deaths, a doubling of deaths. After the culling, when elephant numbers start to increase, we see a dramatic decrease in births and not so more in deaths. This is a recent analysis from the data from the Kruger National Park. I think it's very important when you want to know why are you culling and what happens when you cull. It's not just culling about culling and culling and culling and culling. There are specific responses, and we have to be responsible when we institute a culling, because we understand what the responses will be, and we need to look for those responses. Up to now, not a single culling program in the world would it be to cull badgers in England, or foxes in England, or wolves, or any of these had a desired outcome. It always had an interesting outcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, with due respect, I think perhaps one of the speakers misunderstood us earlier in our comments about black people and hunting and attitudes to black people. What we're saying is that those, and specifically white people, who promote hunting as the economic panacea for all problems in Africa, constantly say that if black people don't appreciate the economic value of animals, then they won't conserve them. And what we're saying is that they are saying to black people that only if you see animal as an economic entity will it have any value to you. What we're saying is that black people have traditionally had far more respect for animals in Africa than white people have. That their hunting was limited to certain levels of society, but also to certain levels of sustainability. So there was certainly no slight intended against the morals and the sociology of black people in that comment, and I hope the speaker previously understands that. I think with regard to the tourist thing, it's important to know that tourism is a very real, as Professor Bernardo said, a very real earner of foreign income for South Africa, and that people come to South Africa because they want to see a package of things, and many people are prepared to sacrifice that package if one aspect of it is distasteful to them. And many people who would come to see the lady's gorge and her rondavel and other places at God's window will forsake the opportunity of seeing those as a protest against culling. Black people sacrificed many things in their lives during the struggle because they wanted to prove a point with what they were doing. They called for boycotts. People
South Africa not to see black people, only they came to see their art and their culture. But that wasn't the reason why people came to South Africa, to see the way black people in South Africa lived. It was one aspect of it. It was an aspect they were prepared to sacrifice as long as those black people were being discriminated against. And we believe that tourists will boycott coming to South Africa in numbers. Many will come. Many hunters, particularly. I worked at Jan Smuts during the high days of apartheid. And many white hunters came to South Africa to hunt without any consideration for the plight of black people in South Africa. They ignored the call to boycott because their bloodlust overrode their social obligations and social responsibilities. In the same way, many tourists will come to South Africa when there are elephants being culled or if elephants ever get culled. But large numbers will not come if culling goes ahead. As far as the point on poverty alleviation, I think Professor Van Aarden has explained it. Tourists bring dollars and pounds and euros into this country. That money gets channeled down to local communities. They sell artifacts, they get jobs in reserves, etc., etc. That is a form of poverty alleviation. When people stop coming to this country for reasons, they reduce the amount of income, and so they reduce the amount of poverty alleviation that would take place. There is still poverty, and there will be poverty, but we don't have to exacerbate that poverty by inviting a boycott of tourists because you want to go ahead with a cull that can never be justified on scientific or ethical grounds.
Thank you.
Foreign tourists come to our country in large numbers because it is cheap for them to come here rather than with us if you want to go and see maybe the snow mountains there outside South Africa. You've got to pay quite a lot of money. So they can afford to come here, not only because of not because of elephants, because there's so many things. Please, let us do away with that thing that they come only, they come because of elephants, and if we kill elephants, they won't come into our country. And our liberation movement has nothing to do with what we are saying, what we are doing, we have here a duty to do, either to stop the exploding number, or to do something, but only if there is reason to know that there is an explosion. I think here, Chairperson, we have we have been given that in the Kruger National Park there are 12,000 elephants. I don't know where this comes from, but Kruger National Park, and then
I think that particular part of it when the department makes their present.
Overpopulated
with
elephants. I don't think we are overpopulated.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Concern. Okay. Now, boom. 10 seconds.
Okay, sorry. Just as we have the purview of our resources to ensure sustainable growth. And this constitution was made possible by the good will of our country, simply by Sudan, Mandela, and Chad. When people are just saying, hey, don't do this thing, and people are taking their feet and running away, things that are not going to happen. It is that. It's a miracle. We shouldn't now be dismayed that if we do what we do, the people will change their side. Why not be dismayed? So when we bring it here to ensure that you see the one, everyone say, oh, you are a model, you do that. Now all of a sudden you must have the frightened into the fact that you are going to do this now, the whole world is going to tell us this. Finally, I find it very easy to justify why I'm not every day slaughter. Cattle and sheep, etc. And, you know, whether we have and you can down start and say, look, other things are circumstances. I find it difficult, but they're all animals. We must appreciate them. There are no people who see, we keep on saying we're not being fine about in the progress and things of God. What gives you the right now to go and have a great beef this afternoon? And all every Sunday, wedding, funerals, cattle, with
And what is the right thing to do? To try to do and not look at the problem. He doesn't say a book with one when he's just a cow. He says, if it is necessary. So it is an extreme eventuality. Now people say, no, don't even consider that at all.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Now I think we will give the department an opportunity to respond and address some of the concerns that we had the last time when they came. And we've got Ms. Lisiho and Sonia at the back. You've heard the arguments, the presentations, what have you and so forth. Now you've got the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much for inviting us, and thank you for the two presentations. Our response is going to be very brief, because we've already presented to you in the coaching, and a lot has already been said. Maybe just to say that indeed a lot of what Professor Ante has said, we are not disputing as a department. I think that is precisely the reason why we have this discussion on the table, that the Minister so fit to develop and the management strategy which will guide the management of elephants in the entire republic. And maybe just to emphasize that again, that this nonsense standards will not only apply to the Kruger National Park or Kali. It's nonsense standards that are going to apply throughout the entire republic, and Kali will be an option in the management plan. And that management plan, it's not like a park manager will wake up tomorrow and say, I'm going to Cal and start calling. It's built in that the management plan will be approved by the relevant authority to avoid the temptation to ever based on history. Has always wanted to apply this principle. So I think it's just those few things. And in terms of other options, including expanding the range, again, an example is in point is our commitment to the TSCA. It's not working extremely well, but it's an effort. And the question was raised about Gonale Zoo and how the sustainability of that side of the park. Maybe just to mention that one of the efforts in demonstration of South Africa's commitment to make sure that the transfrontier conservation areas do work, but not only on integrity and ecology of those ecosystems, but to make sure that there is benefit. We are being targeted as one of the potential strategies for 2010, and that this is the intention of the department to, for instance, organize an investor conference to make sure that as part of 2010 FIFA World Cup, there are benefits that accrue to neighboring countries, and the TSCA has been earmarked as one of those potential areas that some economic benefits can accrue. So that is the commitment towards the migration and making sure that our population are thrive, but in a sustainable manner. And just another maybe a few things. I'm happy you've emphasized that let's not talk about culling in the same context as hunting, because that's two separate issues. And again, to emphasize that the intention of culling is not for economic purposes, it's very clear. If there are any economic purposes, that would be a spin-off from the culling if it does happen. So I would really urge that we separate that from the issues of ivory trade, because ivory trade can happen outside of culling, because there are natural mortalities. So I think briefly that's the responses that I can give. And maybe just to check from my colleague's link, if there's anything that I've omitted, that it will be to the benefit of the House. And again, if there are any questions to the department, you're willing to take.
I just want to add, if I may, that it is very important what Lucille said, that we as a department, when we put together the information that is now in the draft norms and standards, we did it with the best available knowledge that we have at this time. as Professor Van Alder says, the department, the minister this year, has given 5 million rand towards the continuous research of poor elephants in South Africa, and the assessment that Prof. Van Alder talked about is coming out of that money. And that we must remember that we try to put a balanced document on the table, and that we must also not lose sight of it, that we try and prohibit, or we will prohibit, the capture of young elephants from current populations. We private owners of elephants could in the past use or try and get some money to put back into the elephant conservation or conservation of the biodiversity on their private land. They will now not be able to capture young elephants from the wild, and the culling would become an option for them on their land as well. If they don't want to hunt, we must give them the opportunity of also enabling them to cull on their land. Contraception has been said to work better in smaller populations because it's less intrusive or invasive in terms of a small population. It's easier and cheaper. But if a person will not, do not want to do contraceptive, they can always resort to culling. And although it's in a small population, if we do not make provision for that, then they will not be able to use that. Thank you.
Thank you. I will open the floor for questions, but I do have one or two questions from the table. The last time we wanted to know about statistics, even though there's been a sample shown to us this morning to show that at least you can never be quite accurate in pinning down the numbers, but I wanted to know from the department side as to if you could talk to that information to us. And the second thing is I wanted to find out in terms of ecotourism as our flagship in South Africa in terms of job creation, revenue generating, whatever and so forth. Have we thought of putting together a questionnaire and involving tourist agencies, whatever and so forth, in relation to the question of culling, just simply to find out as whether, you know, all the tourists coming in, just have a small little questionnaire. Normally when foreigners come into our country, they would always be given a little form, immigration form, to complete. I was just wondering if we could, in collaboration with the Department of Home Affairs, to have that distributed to all incoming international flights, just to ask them a simple question to say, are they in favor of culling or not? And if not, would they cease coming to South Africa? Let's just simply see the outcomes of that kind of questionnaire. I'll start picking up names. Mike Almas and Tademo Buena. Are there any more takers? No. You'd like to put, I thought the questions were for members, and then if you'd like to respond from what they've said, then you'd have that.
Just in terms of translocation, I would just like to know what is going on at present, and is it something, I know that there were, I think, 2 or 3 young bulls translocated to Addo. Is that ongoing? And because of the whole family situation, is it an option? Or can you only really take the young bulls out who are not sort of part of a matriarchal family? What is the thinking on that? And is it happening? And is it only happening within the borders of South Africa, or are animals being moved outside, like to Angola or other parts of of Southern Africa.
Maybe in Southern Kwena, you'd like to have a question as well before they respond. Or perhaps they should respond and then you can have... Okay, let them respond to the questions that we're posed. Thank you.
Thank you. There's, in the elephant assessment, a specific chapter that's dealing with translocation as such. In the norms and standards, we also have noted the department coming up with suggestions of a unit of six as a minimum unit, etc. Let's look at translocation, the short history thereof. 42 new elephant populations in South Africa have been established by translocating elephants from the Kruger National Park onto either private or public land. South Africa protects about 2.5, maybe 3% of Africa's elephants, and South Africa may have something like 20 to 22,000 elephants. Very few in the bigger picture. However, in conservation sciences and conservation responsibilities, our neighbors are looking at what we are doing to suggest their own issues. Botswana, for instance, they have 1/4 of Africa's elephants, only in Botswana, want to see what we are doing, want to know what's going on with their population, and we are publishing a paper now to show that Botswana's elephants have stopped to increase the numbers for the last 9 to 10 years. It's not true that the number of elephants are increasing there any longer. But they have a large population, and they want to also learn from us what we're doing about these things. Efforts are going right across borders. There are no such things as political entities in conservation sciences. Thank you, Mr. Chen.
I think the department needs to respond on the statistics.
Okay, thank you, Chair. We got the statistics, and like you say, we work on the basis of the best knowledge available. We are happy to inform you that the elephant specialist group of the IUCN, which is a reputable global body in this regard, has released the statistics, and this is the 2007 data. And I think plus minus, Professor. Botswana is 134,000 elephants, Mozambique 14,000, Namibia 18,000, Zambia 17,000, and Zimbabwe 85,000, and last in South Africa 18,000. See, Professor, that is the valid statistics that we can quote with confidence.
What about Angola, the DRC, they are part of the Sahel region.
Yes, they are part of the SADC region, including Mauritius, but I think that elephant populations are I don't want to say insignificant, but unknown because of modalities for counts that are not necessarily because of the situation in those countries. To respond while I have the floor, Chair, one thing to add. In terms of the question around ecotourism and what is the feeling of the population in terms of culling, that has not been done by ourselves, but it's something that we can take back and see whether the South African tourism, which is our public entity responsible for marketing of tourism in this country, considering that this would not be a biodiversity issue to be the impact on our tourism practices, we can take that to our principals back in days. However, what is interesting is that there has been a very recent study done, undertaken by a Japanese student this year, actually just a few weeks ago or a few months ago. She is keen and interested in issues of ivory and trade, and what in that context she came to visit South Africa, and specifically the Kruger National Park. She came back and presented the results to us, and they were very interesting, that you have a range of tourists, both Germany, Netherlands, Holland, Nepal, but the majority of, according to him, and example, majority of the people were actually, if I recall, not against culling, especially South Africans, but most people would say there are a lot of elephants in the Kruger National Park, but he just gave us a very raw presentation before departing back to Japan. Actually, he's studying with a university somewhere in the UK. So we are hoping that when she does finish her, I think it's a master's thesis, she will give us the outcome. And that's the only thing that is recent that we can say it has been done, even though, and maybe it's interesting that it's done by an independent a person of a different origin and studying, not even in your own country of origin, studying in the UK. So it will be interesting to see what results come out. But the initial responses were quite interesting. Thank you. And Ms. Ming, did you want to add anything on? Oh, yeah, and then of course, the tourism was in relation to the questionnaire. Of course, there are other programs that the department supports, including our expanded public works program, which falls under the branch of social responsibility. A lot of our funding goes to infrastructure development in conservation areas to make sure that, first of all, those conservation areas can be self-sustaining in terms of their ability to raise the living. And we believe that most of the, like most of our parks, the reason why they make better money than our South African National Biodiversity Institute is taking is based on the infrastructure that occurs in those facilities. So there is that effort, and we are investing some money as a department in that regard. Thank you. Ms. Nagy, would like to say, do you share?
Thank you. I would just like to add on the translocation. We must just remember that because elephant, you know, it's a big species and it needs space. Translocation is not that easy because we haven't got enough habitat, or I won't say not enough, but restricted habitat where we can keep elephants. And because of human development, those areas, you know, become less and less. And because in southern Africa we've got what did you say, Prof? How many of Africa's elephants? 2%. You know, and because of the size of the animals, it's not easy to translocate family groups, which we regard as the ultimate, say, six animals is the ultimate group for translocation. It's not easy to do that. It's expensive, and in southern Africa, we've got... you know, we haven't got habitat to translocate those things to. Thank you.
Adam Brenner, I think you'd be the last final.
Yeah. Jefferson, mine is the closest point. Can you just provide a sense of the ministry is dealing with a set of understanding for 100 minutes. Now, how do you proceed? We had a presentation at the time, and now we're going to see it. And you see that was a process. The minister says, I need to settle this hereby issue. We need to decree, and that ends the service at once. That is the process, and I'm reading into that the question of public hearing, any of the ourselves or the department is already done that. So what is the process?
If one may ask, has there been any public hearing for the issue?
Can I use a different language to public hearings? There has been public consultations, but not within the parliamentary process. We have received, like I said in our previous presentation last time, that we had a series of comments. The consultation is still ongoing. After meeting reports that yesterday we had a meeting with a representative of the Veterinary Council to address some of the very specific issues, because that was really to craft this document, that is a policy document that we rely on the experts out there. The process is that After considering that as a technocrat, we are going to submit to the minister with a recommendation. The minister, if he agrees with the recommendations, will then take it through the approval processes through the committee of the minister and the NSC, which is called MINNEC.
and the next meeting, I think that we are targeting the November meeting, and then it will be the prerogative of the minister to then take it forward, but it has to go to our state law advisors for certification. But before all that happens, we still want to have a series of last consultation workshops to say, this is what was published, this the cocktail of, for lack of a better word, of comments that came, this is where we agree or disagree and why, and then finally make the recommendation to the minister for the amendment, and giving the time for legal drafting, because the comments come as inputs that you have to consider the comments in totality to see how you then effect them into the changes that make sense and they don't have unintended consequences. So that's where we are. So we are hoping that we might be talking of documents to be submitted to the Department of Justice for certification or vetting sometime in December.
The essence of my question is simply that the minister is introducing this set of non-standard standards within the framework of NEMA, which is the Act of Parliament. Now, we are deployed here to conduct oversight over the minister to make sure he does the proper department. Now, we should not be let off the election of duty and then go with the minister here on, because there is something wrong here. In the constitutional challenge, we'll be playing for the in a way. Now, we want to make sure that these laws and standards have been exposed to maximum public awareness. And that's why it's important to have public hearings. I don't know who must contact the public with ourselves or the minister, but here it is now, regulation is now. It's not like a typical piece of legislation. Now, but then we are going to ensure that now that process of exposure has been there. Now here, the lady is talking about consultation and public hearings are two separate things.
I think in view of...
There should be rigorous public hearings, especially because of the new interest in the dynamics surrounding this.
I think they've mentioned the fact that the department is undertaking, is embarking on its own processes. Now, in view of the fact that this is a highly sensitive area in terms of people who are pro-life and those who are some who are anti-culling, I think for us it would be important to make sure that, independent from the department, we have our own process of making sure that all sides are heard, so that when we do apply our minds, if ever we are going to make any amendments or perhaps concur with whatever is going to come from the department, it's based on a position of at least facts. So I think that's how the process is going to unfold. I think this, if we don't have anybody, any more takers, this will bring us to the end of our meeting, the meeting's adjourned. Before I could say that, I see a hand coming from my left.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Can I make a comment, if you don't mind? I think that there were two points made by the lady, I didn't give her name, from DEET. One was concerned the issue of hunting and culling. I'd just like to make it clear that although hunting doesn't take place at a level which affects the number of animals that are ultimately culled, culling animals does provide hunters with an opportunity to select animals which are of trophy value, and therefore the whole process of culling is vastly supported by the hunting fraternity. They put out a proposal that they be given access to animals that are going to be culled, and they are encouraging culling. They are very supportive of the whole culling thing. So
you also have a situation where problem animals are culled, and they designate as problem animals because they break out of the pot. As you mentioned earlier, there is evidence to prove, and there's currently an investigation in Limpopo relating to deliberate removal of elephants from the parks by people wanting to hunt them and creating so-called problem animals to satisfy the hunting demand. The second point that was made was about the Japanese students who did her little research on tourists coming to South Africa. I think it's somewhat of a... I don't think it's accidental that Japan is the country shouting for the lifting of the ivory ban more than anyone else, because most ivory in the world other than China now is processed in Japan. Japan has a vested interest in ivory being traded on the market. And on that point, the amount of ivory that's required to satisfy the demand of both China and Japan is so high that it does encourage culling, because ultimately culling will provide that ivory. Natural mortality will never satisfy that demand. And so although geese will deny the fact that ivory is an incentive, because they cannot publicly say that, it is going to influence the decision on culling, because there will be stockpiles of ivory. And if I can just go back to a point made by the lady at the back here about leaving elephants to be food for vultures, I think there also needs to be an understanding by people that there's a cycle of nutrients in nature, and that animals that die naturally have grown out of the soil and should be able to return to the soil. If you remove those carcasses from the soil, you're actually depleting, as you would a farm that you constantly farm with maize or with any other product and remove it from the land. You have to ultimately apply fertilizers to retain the value of that land in providing good food. And by removing the carcasses of all animals from the reserve, there will ultimately be a depletion of some of the very important trace elements from those areas. Thank you.
I thank you. Your comments have been noted. This brings us to the end of our meeting. Lunch is served at the old assembly. I would ask members of the management committee to remain for maybe about 10 minutes, and we'll catch up with the rest of you in the old assembly.